Good night, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another State of Our Nation. We know it's been quite a while since we have had a broadcast, but obviously this is a special occasion post the 2025 budget. I have with me to help me unpack. It was quite a bit. It was the maiden budget delivered by the Honorable Ryan Strong, Minister in the Ministry of Finance, the first budget to be delivered by someone who is not the substantive Minister of Finance. I am subject to correction for that. I have with me Professor Troy Lord, and he's a distinguished academic, currently serving as the Dean of the Faculty of Social Sciences at the University of the West Indies, Cable Campus. Professor Lord holds a BSc from UWI with first class honors, a master's from York University, and a PhD from the University of Surrey. Professor Lord's research focuses primarily on international tourism, international trade in small island states. According to research papers in economics, he ranks among the top 11 percentile of researchers in Central America and the Caribbean, in the top 16% in Latin America and the Caribbean. So we are quite privileged and honored to have you join us, Professor Lord. Welcome. And we hope that we can get through as much as we can in this hour as we try to unpack this all. Now, before we get into to everything, I mean, there's quite a bit that was brought out. We saw the salt tax. We saw the taxes reduce for regional travel. We saw a removal of VAT on an expansion of those baskets of goods, which would suggest some relief for poor persons. And obviously, the big question of how this budget is going to help Barbadians mitigate these external exogenous issues that are cropping up, the budding trade war that seems to be looming, etc. So before we delve into those questions, I want to get your initial take of what your thoughts were on the budget, Professor Lord. Do you think it ticked those boxes?
Good night, Colville, and good night to the rest of our listeners. So yeah, as you said, it's a lot to unpack in such a short space of time, given that it just ended, but I made a few notes. And so what I will do first is I think I will probably give kind of an overview of the overall budget. I'll probably give, you know, some ratings, a score, kind of out of a 5-point scale. So in relation to, say, growth and fiscal stability, I mean, as they indicated, the real GDP grew by 4% in 24, which exceeds pre-pandemic levels. Our debt to GDP ratio is coming down. It's just over 100%, roughly 101%, I think I heard in the budget. You know, foreign reserves have increased. I know there's a lot of concern there about whether that is too many weeks of cover. It's at 31 weeks. And, you know, there's a number of projects and renovations have boosted, you know, the tourism sector and broadly tourism, or I should say investor confidence. I mean, but a challenge there is, of course, going to be our debt servicing costs. I mean, you know, interest payments are going to remain high. And it's a thing that is a feature of most small states, is we have a limited economic diversification. I mean, we are very dependent upon tourism. I mean, we tout it, of course, but truthfully, you know, we're still making very slow progress in expanding alternative sectors. Things that we've spoken about for a while in terms of renewable energy products, our renewable energy industries, our sectors, and digital industries. And we saw, so overall, that overall rating, if I were to give it one, I would say broadly speaking, about 4 to 5. So there's positive fiscal progress, but there's still some challenges in terms of diversification. In terms of social protection and public welfare, I guess I will give that 3 to 5. We have some progress in terms of legislative reforms, but I still think there's a lot of delays in execution and funding. So in terms of successes, I mean, he identified that 791 persons benefited, and there was a draft elderly protection bill, and some daycare facility construction in Stirling and in St. Thomas. But overall, I'd say that there's, generally speaking, I would say, still insufficient funding for elder care facilities. There's been a lot of good work, I would say, in terms of climate resilience. It seems most times when I read about loans that the government has secured, in some way, form, or fashion, it speaks to resilience. So you know that we've had very recently a debt for climate swap, the first of its kind in the world. We're looking to really launch, you know, the facilitation of, or say restoration of, you know, secure water resources for Barbadians. And so there's some work there. You mentioned 600 gallon tank storage tanks for vulnerable households being a mechanism to support resilience in that regard. I'd still say, though, that there's a lack of clarity on the Resilience Regeneration Fund's governance, particularly in terms of transparency and fund allocation. And it's still, I would say, a bit of a unfortunate circumstance that residents in St. Lucie and St. Peter are still facing discolored water. So 4 to 5 in terms of climate resilience and disaster prep. Crime, that's a big thing. You know, we mentioned recruiting officers, 47 more in training, proposal to transition special constables into full-time roles, and $2 million allocated for public, for police vehicles and crime prevention. But we still are understaffed in terms of the police service. We mentioned 250 vacancies are yet to be filled. And there will, of course, need to be an amendment to the Police Act to transition special constables. Sorry. So efforts are being made, but we'd say that there's still a lot of work to be done. So 3 to 5, I'd probably speak about in terms of crime and public safety. Health and non-communicable diseases is another broad area. I mean, work is being done there. I mean, it was mentioned, yeah, that deaths due to non-chronic communicable diseases is still very high, over 80%. And so government is trying there in terms of it's placing excise taxes on a number of high salted foods and so forth. I mean, I'd say that I understand that. I don't know, though, that truthfully, I mean, it's something that we did do it with sugar in terms of sweet drinks. And I mean, I've heard some numbers that suggest there's some small reductions. I don't know, though, that this is sufficient really to get, you know, us on the right direction as far as those types of foods are concerned. I still think that it's really going to be a lot more effort. I mean, yes, I know that those in the medical sciences, certainly my colleagues in the faculty of medical sciences would, you know, be very pleased with this. And perhaps it's a start. I don't think it's really going to get us where we want to go. I mean, but challenges still remain. But I think, you know, at least they're thinking about it. We know that the cost of healthcare for non-communicable diseases is very high. And so we want to do everything we can to encourage persons to live healthier lifestyles. In terms of education and skill development, this is real Alan in my first statement. I mean, they are mentioning expansion of digital training and either looking at training and also artificial intelligence. And that's good. I mean, we'd have to really get a fuller idea of really where they intend to go there. There's a discussion. There was a broad discussion of the skills we may need in the future. I heard Mr. Minister Strawn basically called the numbers of students in each cohort at the secondary school level, suggesting that, you know, overall we're going to face a 44% decline in school enrollment over the next decade, experience that over the last decade, and this will have future issues in terms of our labor market stability. And so, you know, a new talent strategy, global visa incentives was mentioned. It's a good policy direction, perhaps. I know it's one that's going to come with a lot of pushback, naturally, because anything that is different from what we've become used to for decades is going to be a bit, you know, it's new, and persons are going to need a lot of education where that is concerned. So broadly speaking, that's good. So 3 to 5 for that. If I just recap my numbers again, economic growth and fiscal stability, 4 to 5, social protection and welfare, 3 to 5, climate resilience, 4 to 5, crime and public safety, 3 to 5, health and NCDs, 4 to 5, education and skill development, 3 to 5. So that's where I will land for now.
Okay. quite interesting scorecard. But I want to double back on something that you touched on, and it's something that I guess would be explored in the coming days. Mm-hmm. The increase on some salted snacks, some imported, some made locally, some are made locally, like the Conkers and so on. We do have that sector that makes those things, some of those things locally. And then also the incremental increase of minimum wage. I mean, we don't know what the new minimum wage is going to land on as yet, but the incremental increase from January 2026 of the minimum wage, is this something that is going to raise some concern for the business sector as it relates to cost of living? Is that something that's going to eventually pass back on to the customer? And the manufacturing sector, is this something that would cause any alarm to them in any way whatsoever?
Well, so Colville, so full disclosure, I'm a member of the minimum wage board, discussing the current initiative really to increase the minimum wage. I also sat on the last one when we implemented the minimum wage for the first time in Barbados. So let's put it this way. When we did the first exercise, I mean, there was some concern from the commercial sector in Barbados about, you know, the impact on their bottom lines. And of course, several businesses being unable to handle that, especially small businesses. They're less profitable. And of course, cash flow is always an issue. But of course, that we understand the concerns. But on the other hand, you know, we want to ensure that persons have a certain amount of income to be able to purchase basic goods and services. So for persons on minimum wages, you know, they want to be able to do certain things. They want to be able to purchase food, pay rents, pay utilities, have, you know, these types of basic services. And so households like that, there has to be a certain amount of income in each household in order to, you know, let's just say at least live at a comfortable level. And we're also talking about it in terms, when we say food, not just any food, but food that has a certain sort of caloric value so that persons are able to function to do the jobs that they're working in. And so at that time, the focus was originally on security services and also domestics. I mean, this time it's a broader mandate. We want to do a lot of sectoral work. But the work has only just gotten started. I'll also make clear to listeners, because I imagine persons would say, like, why wait till 2026? But we were only just reconvened a few months ago. And so the work now really has to be done. And we want to do a good job. And we also want to do it against a backdrop where, you know, inflation is rising and so forth. So we also think of a mechanism where perhaps, you know, there's like a ratchet. So based on whatever is the rate of inflation, you know, that there's a ratchet that would raise the minimum wage up to another level without always having to come back to the board to do an analysis to kind of, in a sense, start from scratch again. So there's a trade-off, in a sense, is what I'm saying, Colville. Yes, it is going to affect, of course, those businesses, those sectors that pay persons at the bottom of the minimum wage scale. But no, I mean, in the first instance, you don't have to pay people at the bottom just because there's a minimum wage that exists. You can pay them more. But at the same time, you know, if persons are unable to purchase goods and services in the economy, of course, by extension, there's another way in which you're going to have to pay, because then you're going to have to do a lot more in terms of the welfare services to provide for persons that are unable to really pay for goods and services. So even if there's no direct payment, if there was no direct payment, there's going to be indirect payment, because then there's going to be a greater pressure on government to provide for those that aren't able to, you know, at least have a minimum level of income to survive.
And the salt tax, in terms of the manufacturing sector, do you think that there is going to be some backlash where that is concerned?
Right. So this is an interesting tax. Yes, I would say so. But the thing is that I think government is caught between a rock and a hard place, in a sense where I suppose you could say that if government had no concern with survival of those firms or those businesses or the persons who work there, They could just raise the tax so high that literally no one would buy these things because they just would be completely unaffordable. It would make no sense to pay for things like, say, they didn't mention a pack of peanuts. I think a pack of peanuts may be just over $1 right now, roughly speaking, let's say. But if imagine government raised the tax to the point where that same pack of peanuts was, say, $5 or $10, no one would buy them. But then the businesses themselves would, of course, close because no one was purchasing their products. But on the other hand, government does have a very large bill when it comes to treatment of persons that suffer from non-communicable diseases. So the monies that we are directing there, of course, is a burden we all bear. And the other thing about health is that an unhealthy population also is an unproductive population. So as if persons are having to be, to go to the hospital or the polyclinics for treatments, or they're on many medications, all of these things affect their productivity, it affects their well-being, both physical and mental. And of course, broadly speaking, it means then they're not as productive in terms of their contribution to the economy in many ways, not just in terms of the economy, but in terms of the other ways in which persons contribute to the well-being of society. But to circle back to your question again, I think that the 20%, I think it was, is perhaps, I would imagine that government has considered, likely the sort of reduction in demand that would come about from a 20% increase. This is something that we would, this is something that we would teach students of economics in first year, the elasticity of demand, the price elasticity of demand. So when the price goes up by 20%, they should have some idea of the reduction in demand for purchasing these things. The other thing is, I think, though, of course, the main thing is to try to target these things that young persons. Persons in primary, secondary school, especially, because you want them to, inculcate in them healthy lifestyles from the very beginning. Persons that are, for many Barbadians, I mean, there's a little chuckling in the when this was being read by Minister Strawn, about people liking, the salt pigtails and so on and so forth. Yeah, I guess, for many, it's something that is perhaps. I don't, the word isn't necessarily addiction, but let's just say they are used to certain levels of salt. It will be difficult to, reduce their level to the point where there was none. But the point is really to get to this point for government where we spend less money on treatment of non-communicable diseases because these are preventable. So from the perspective of the firms, the businesses, the industries that produce, salty foods or sugary foods, because that tax existed already, I think they know there's going to be some fallout. But I've seen what these businesses have done as well is to try to produce healthier alternatives. So it incentivizes them to do this if there's a reduction in the salty snacks or the sugary drinks. The incentive now will be to get healthier alternatives, to get persons turned on to these particular products. So in some ways, it incentivizes them to innovate.
Well, while this may not be your wheelhouse per se in terms of trying to determine the rationale by which government selected the natural selection of these snacks that were singled out for taxes, I mean, because I think that there might be some concern raised as to what were the metrics used to determine that these products had higher salt content than maybe. For example, a cube of Maggi would have a very high salt content, but you don't exactly use a lot of cube of a whole cube of Maggi every time or whatever the case is. So, what exactly is the metrics that would have been used to determine, well, all right, these products should be singled out for taxes as opposed to just saying, okay, products that are high in salt, because it just can't be as cut and dry as high in salt.
Well, let's put it this way. Typically you find that on the labels on the packages, it gives you the caloric content and the different, amount of salt, sugar, and various other minerals and so forth per, whatever. And it tells you, and it also tells you, most of us don't really follow it. It tells you how many, servings a particular package has and whatnot, and what you ought to take. So, for example, it may say milligrams. If it was saying sodium content, it may say milligrams per 100 grams or so forth, or chloride, or you know, whatever salinity. It does give you some idea, and there's going to be benchmarks that exist. You know, what is the healthy amount of salt that you should consume per day, and it will also give you in terms, of course, based on size. It will give you based on gender, male, female. It will give you based on your body, your weight, and so forth. What is a healthy consumption of salt per day, and so on and so forth. So when you take these into consideration, then they can then use these benchmarks to determine based on what is in, you know, a pack of corn kernels, a pack of salted peanuts, or what have you, whether these things are, you know, exceed the basically amount of daily recommended amounts.
Okay. Now, I see that government would have, it wouldn't quite be a social compact, we'll say, but the VAT removal on certain items, I guess expanding somewhat the basket of goods. One may consider that this may be in anticipation of maybe even further inflation and increasing cost of living, due to what we are now seeing as, you know, the potential trade wars that may erupt from the United States, etc. Do you think this is going to be sufficient given the fallout that may be anticipated? If, you know, obviously it is still up in the air because the president of the United States seemed to be 1 minute rolling out taxes, then the next minute pulling them back. Do you think that, you know, should the wars happen? I mean, are these measures going to be efficient to give a soft landing of sorts to the most vulnerable in society?
Okay, that's a good question. So that's the one thing. I mean, perhaps the timing was difficult because, I mean, what goes into the construction of a budget would have started months ago and so likely preceded some of what we're seeing now from the Trump administration. But I did still think, I mean, and there was some allusion to it in the budget, to be quite honest. I don't know if they had enough time to really perhaps do a sort of estimation of what would likely happen. But I will say this. So right now, yes, a lot of the threats, because you're not really sure whether they're going to go through, but let's just assume they are, because it's still going to, even if you don't do them, I mean, they're just saying you're going to do them is going to have some effect on the markets. And so you see a lot of volatility like that. And so there's the Trump administration has threatened to place tariffs on Mexico and Canada, its main trading partners in the USMCA, that trade agreement, a free trade agreement, and then China. And so they have immediately retaliated. But it's, the thing about it, it's not going to be contained to those countries. It's going to spread. Europe is also, you know, thinking already that they're likely to also be next. And so they're also preparing plans to do so. And so now how does that all affect us? Well, you know, we have a high import propensity. And so there isn't anything that's going to happen globally that's going to spare us. And so from simple things like, well, it's not simple things, but in terms of our supply chains, things that we use to manufacture goods, but things that we directly import, all of these things are going to go up in costs. And it's not going to be clear because, of course, everything is going to be affected. So it's not merely, for example, if the tariffs of some goods go up by, say, 20%, that's the external, you know, amount, then it's going to have an effect on the transportation costs. You're going to see some effect there. Then, of course, we in Barbados, we have our own tariffs. I mean, we put duties on most things, really, except perhaps for, you know, some things like educational items, like, you know, computers and books and so forth. But, you know, it's going to be a compounded effect. Now, the question is whether, you know, the ease in taxation on the income side is going to be sufficient to mitigate that. And the short answer is simply no. That's not going to happen. I mean, at least it's going to be somewhat of a buffer, but it will be insufficient really to likely deal with that. And not only that, you know what's been predicted very recently is that the Federal Reserve in Atlanta has recently just forecasted that the United States economy is going to contract by 2.4% in the first quarter of 2025. And there's likely going to, it's likely and it's been predicted that the economy, the US economy is going to go into recession. And you know, there's a well-known saying in Barbados, which is that if the United States sneezes, Barbados catches a cold, right? And so we may not feel the full effect of that in tourism right away, because of course, a lot of the bookings for tourism were done before and people may still complete their trips to Barbados, but you're going to see some, and it's going to happen with a lag. It's not going to happen in the same quarter, but you're likely going to start to see the effects of what's happening in the United States and globally is definitely going to have an effect on Barbados. We can't be spared. We're a small, open economy. And so there's no global instability, whether it's civil unrest, whether it's like this, a trade war where Barbados could ever escape. The economy is no economy these days, no economy in the world is sufficiently ring fenced from these things. I mean, the biggest economies in the world, I mean, those are the ones that at least are best placed to, let's say, provide assistance to their citizens to kind of shield them from the worst of the effects. But nobody's going to be spared.
So if you were to be solution oriented, then what more could have been added to shield the vulnerable of against what is likely to come in terms of mitigating measures?
You asked me a hard question. Right. Yeah, so here's what. So here's this. So the sort of things that I'll say this, the things that I would recommend are perhaps things that we've spoken about for Barbados for a long time. They're actually really not short term. Some of them, well, they have probably different lengths of implementation. And so, I mean, broadly speaking, and to the extent this is not necessarily a government thing only. You know, we've for many years, we've spoken about diversification of the Barbadian economy. But this is not something for government to do. Government really is just really to facilitate it in terms of legislation and so forth to create the environment. But really, when we speak of diversification and the types of things that they do, it has to come from the private sector. There has to be opportunities that are available and then that the private sector takes advantage of to really help the Barbadian economy to diversify. You know, that's broadly what I'd say. Diversification is something that we have to, and we also have to be cognizant that what we're seeing now globally is perhaps what's going to happen. I mean, we've been used to a certain sort of alignment globally. But even though, yes, we're speaking about Trump, the Trump administration as some sort of anomaly, really what it is more so that what we're seeing from him in terms of the American government, the America as a whole, is really just kind of an acceleration of what we're seeing, which is that there's a sort of retreat from, you know, multilateralism and the role that the United States has played for a long time. And we understand why to some degree, because, you know, in the same ways that Barbadians will speak about things being very hard, Americans, the middle class, and those in lower income brackets, they also feel, well, you know, why are we spending, meaning them, the American government, spending so much money on all of these external things like foreign aid and so forth. And just to show you what I mean, when there was a recent poll asking United States citizens what percentage of their budget do they think the United States spends on foreign aid, and that was 31%. They thought the government spent as high as 31%, when really and truly the number is close to 1% of the budget that goes towards foreign aid, right? But you understand, and you understand because of the sort of economic insecurity they feel. But circling back to your question, you know, because I'm trying to really speak about what I mentioned those things because I'm saying, so Barbados, the Caribbean, small states have now to really recognize that there's a different realignment of states globally, and that the United States, while it wishes to maintain its role as the hegemon, you know, in a unipolar world, it's going to be multipolar. There are going to be different countries that are really going to really have a big say on what happens globally. And, you know, we have to be nimble and think very carefully how we're going to respond. Locally, though, I mean, one of the ways in which you've said that we've had to really improve is really to do a lot more to improve our own local food production. And we speak about this in terms of food security, but that might be more properly called food sovereignty, because food security isn't really just about growing your own food, even though that's a part of the equation, right? Obviously, if you have secure supply chains when it comes to food, you'd have food security. Well, we know that this isn't necessarily the case. I'm just saying that food security doesn't only speak about growing your own food. It's really about the supply chains, whether those are local or whether those are external. The point is that they have to be secure. And our own food security here in Barbados isn't just about, I know people like to say, well, put more lands into food. But I'd say that's just not the only solution. Barbados would actually be in a glut of basically any food it produces if all the lands were used to produce foods, because, you know, Barbados is only, let's call it 280,000 persons, and we have more than enough land to supply Barbadians with the food that we produce here for consumption. We actually would need to export it. So, you know, definitely the issues there in Barbados in terms of helping will be to really have and secure good water resources, good supply of water resources. And there was a discussion of that. The rate for water, the cubic per cubic meter, has been lowered. And they said will be lowered from $1.80 per cubic meter to $1. So that's you know, a cry that the government has heard. At least they've done some work there, because the farmers were crying out for a long time when it went from 60 cents per cubic meter to $1.80. But now they're reducing it to $1. So at least that should help in terms of their ability to, you know, produce food profitably. There's some other things we can do, Colville. I mean, a lot of the work that we've been talking about for many years is renewable energy. I mean, from the time I was a child, we've spoken about this, but this isn't only about just getting hot water to bathing in the morning and at nighttime. This is we're really using renewable energy to really drive down the cost of manufacturing, drive down the cost of production, because electrical energy is a huge input into manufacturing. So in terms of expansion of the renewable energy incentives for households, for businesses, that would be something that would also help to help us to buttress the sort of things that we see happening abroad. I'd say that now, in terms of government's ability to fund public welfare programs, what I would like to see is a bit more support from the private sector in terms of helping government to you know, help those that are less fortunate in society. I think that, you know, even as we want to do things like perhaps offer persons basic incomes and so forth, I think a big part of what government has tried to do is to try to secure work for persons. It's been happening by various names. So remember, we had the quote unquote, the asphalt workers. And then we had, you know, different programs where they would be beautifying the roads, keeping the roads clear and clean. You know, have the NICAR program. And there are a number of ways in which government then tries to say, well, you can, you know, these are jobs that can be done and you'll be provided with incomes. And broadly speaking as well, another way in which government has done this, and people don't necessarily think of it this way, but the NTI, the training initiative, you know, to get persons to think about retooling, because sometimes, you know, you are in a sector, the job that you have may be import competing, and you know, you find perhaps that you could either get laid off because there's not enough work, or the wages you get, they're low because the sector, the firm is uncompetitive. And so persons also have to think about retooling, reskilling, to really confront the sort of, you know, volatility we're going to see globally. But again, I'll sum it here, Colville. What we're seeing happening globally, we have to expect that is going to be the new norm. Okay. Trade wars, a lot of volatility. You know, what you're seeing happening in terms of the threat and the implementation of tariffs is definitely going to lead to a recession, but not only in America. It's going to lead to a recession in Canada, and likely it's going to lead to a recession in some countries across Europe. So our main trading partners are going to be affected. And you find, of course, when persons living in countries feel insecure, travel is not something that is going to be at, you know, a priority for them, because they're going to want to save those resources in anticipation of, you know, either job loss or some other insecurity.
Okay. Now, still quite a bit to unpack, but I'm going to narrow it down to three more questions.
Mm-hmm.
We saw that the restaurants had something in it for them as well, outside of those that are in the hotels, attached to hotels.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Restaurants can now access concessions, duty-free concessions. What do you think that does anything for our attractiveness as a destination, maybe as prices may come down for restaurants? What spin-off benefit to the tourism sector would that yield? And maybe for locals as well too.
Right. So I will say this. I find it's been an observation, and it's easy to find evidence here. Generally speaking, you find when the government reduces the input costs to businesses in Barbados, the costs are not passed on, right? Usually, if it's something you tend to hear them say, well, if it's something they're selling, like goods, in this case, it's goods and services because it's restaurants, they will likely say something like, well, they have to get rid of the old stock first because they paid the taxes or the whatever on the old stock. So they have to sell that first before they can then, you know, apply with the new lower taxes, do this. And think back just recently when the corporation tax for firms in Barbados was lowered, right? From, it was, I think, 20-something percent. I forget the exact number, down to as low as like about 5.5%. We didn't find any commensurate reduction in the cost of goods or services when that happened a few years ago, when the Prime Minister lowered that in, you know, to basically, when we were threatened as, you know, to say, well, we have this gap between what foreign businesses were being taxed and local businesses. And so they, I guess, we would have thought that that would happen. That didn't happen. We didn't see any commensurate, we didn't see any sort of real noticeable declines in the goods and services that were offered by firms who then overnight had a very sharply lower tax rate. And if I go back again to, let's just say when Sandals first came to Barbados, I don't remember the exact period, but between 2008 and 18, in a window in the 2008-13, roughly speaking, I mean, they got a whole raft of concessions, pretty much paying no import duties or imposts on anything, and even to the extent for persons that were hired from abroad and so forth. So there was a 25-year window for that, and then those were reduced to 50% in the following 15 years. And it was said, you know, and I mean, what happened then was this, yes, the local tourism establishments, so the hotels, large and small, would have fought saying, well, the playing field should be level, right? And so then eventually, after a bit of fight by the government, these things were offered to them. And I would say, and you know, we would be hard pressed to find that there seemed to be, at least in terms of the prices that they offer, that there's been a reduction. I mean, they would argue, and perhaps there's some truth in this, that these help them to be competitive with their counterparts in other countries. But my point is, what you would find then is that simply means is that it helps them to be competitive to the extent that, yeah, their input costs go way down. They could perhaps, if you're talking competition, typically you compete in several ways. You can compete on price, but you can compete in quality. You know what I mean? So with a combination of however they've made that determination, we didn't really feel persons who use those sorts of services, whether you go to hotels or whether you go to restaurants, I don't think, you know, Barbadians themselves would have noticed any sort of, you know, real change in the prices of those things. One would say, well, it's possible then that having been able to secure, you know, your inputs that are imported at lower prices because the duties are off or much lower, certainly they pay a different VAT rate, half of what we pay and whatnot. Perhaps these are things that could be passed on to persons that work at these firms, these organizations, you know, the domestics, you know, that do the maid services, the maintenance and so forth. I am unaware that they were able to benefit from any sort of reduction in the inputs of those hotels and now restaurants. In fact, we know quite frankly, by seeing the sort of unrest we've seen, well, when I say unrest, meaning the sort of, let's just say, kind of contentious negotiations between the unions and the hotel sector, that, you know, the workers really didn't get any benefit. So if the workers didn't get any benefit, and we haven't seen price reductions that make us say, well, okay, they've passed it on, then you have your answer, Colville. Yes, they will benefit, I would say, directly. Their input costs are lower. It helps their bottom line. But you're not going to see different restaurants. You're not going to see cheaper restaurant meals. No.
But let's be devil's advocate and say mm-hmm. that the intent mm-hmm. was followed to the letter, mm-hmm. and we did see them pass on those prices. Would it impact the competitiveness of the destination?
Well, yeah, certainly. I mean, definitely, yeah. I mean, if they lower their prices, so we're talking restaurants here. And so it's not typically the case that tourists travel to a country to, the restaurant is part of the overall experience, yes.
Right. Certainly, and when they're, and just to interject mm-hmm. briefly, I mean, the whole idea as Barbados is a very expensive destination. Yes, we are trying to maybe enter in the realm of a luxury destination, but mm-hmm. it is still considered a rather expensive destination. I mean, had they, let's say, upon receiving these concessions, and they translate that into cheaper prices for dining at these establishments, mm-hmm. I mean, could it impact the outlook as to the expensiveness of Barbados as a destination and thereby our competitiveness?
I mean, it would help, but the biggest item in the basket when it comes to travel is the accommodation. Yeah. And so persons are going to spend more money on accommodation than anything else. And so really for our competitiveness vis-a-vis, let's just at least say our counterparts in the region, and perhaps, you know, let's just say other island destinations. So places like the Seychelles or Mauritius and other islands in the Pacific, I'd say that unless the cost of our accommodation goes down, yes, you know, I would have to admit, yeah, sure. If the cost of meals at restaurants declines, then it does have some impact on our overall competitiveness. But unless the accommodation does a lot more, no. And I know this. And what I will say this is, this is anecdotal. But I'm sure you've experienced it. I don't know from when it started, but certainly when I go into supermarkets, you know, I find that there's a lot more tourists shopping at the supermarkets, because it's just perhaps so costly to, you know, buy all your meals at a restaurant. And another thing, of course, that they're more inclined to do than ever before is to take public transportation, right? And you see them taking the public transportation, not just because it's just a matter of trying to experience the island, you know, just as the residents of the island do, but because it's just, you know, more affordable, right? So yeah, but then saying on the other side of that, I understand why. I think what happens when it comes to pricing for accommodation, and why it's so high, is because tourism in Barbados is highly, highly seasonal. So that, I suppose, the thinking might be that, well, we have to make the most we can in the tourist season, because it's during the low season. We may either shut altogether, or, you know, we expect to be, you know, very low occupancy. And so what you find, those that stay open do things like, you know, offer staycation rates. But if you've looked at those as well, I mean, staycation rates, well, lower than the tourist season rates, they're still very high for the average Barbadian. It's not the case that it it drops to something like 100 Barbados dollars, it may drop to 200 US Barbados dollars tonight, as opposed to any tourist season, 1,000 odd Barbados dollars a night. So that's just the nature of our tourism product.
Okay. Now, we see that regional travel got, you know, somewhat of some attention. Mm-hmm. You know, that has been a major bugbear for many persons, the cost of regional travel.
Yeah.
Barbados seems to be, I don't know, taking a step out front, reducing their travel tax for regional mm-hmm. travelers, albeit
yes.
Just 1 year. I don't know if this is because of the regathering and that sort of stuff.
Right.
That cut from $35 to $20, how big of a dent in terms of travel tax is that? And do you think that might give some impetus for other countries to maybe follow suit?
Well, yes. I mean, on our end, yeah, that is a significant decline, 35 to 20. That is not quite a third, maybe about 40%. Nonetheless, so that's a significant drop. But for it to matter, for us to really feel it, for it to make a real difference in terms of regional travel, the other countries would have to follow suit, right? Because, you know, we pay taxes going and coming. And so you'd have to see it there. But the thing is that really what we want is not a dollar tax. What we want is a drop in the rate. I mean, a real significant decline. Because then so when it comes to these taxes, we know then that, yes, they cover a number of things. Sometimes it's a development tax if an airport is going in development. And some will say even when the airports are no longer, you know, undergoing renovations or expansion, it's still city tax, which is true. But then sometimes you see it tied to things like security and another things, and maybe something related to health, because of course that's another issue that's of importance when you're crossing borders. But the other countries would have to definitely do something. The other countries would definitely have to also participate in reducing the taxes in order to see, you know, more of a impetus for persons to travel regionally. But then it goes even beyond that, Colville. Regional transportation isn't all of the, you know, the best. I mean, we saw the Liat came to a halt in terms of regional travel, even though there's attempts by the Prime Minister of Antigua to rekindle Liat, to restart Liat. What I will say is that, and we've had since then Inter-Caribbean come and is, you know, doing a good job in terms of providing regional transportation. But, you know, traveling regionally is still very difficult, huh? And we know part of it, truthfully, some routes are not very profitable. It's certainly not very profitable to fly to every day. They don't have the volume of traffic to support, you know, the landing and the takeoffs, which is one of the reasons why Liat failed, because it was flying perhaps routes that were not profitable. It's not to say they shouldn't get service. I'm just saying perhaps the frequency of the service is part of the problem. But, you know, apart from, of course, that ability to fly to other Caribbean countries a lot more cheaply when it comes to the tickets, the others would have to do it. But I would like to say it isn't only that part of it that we want to see happen. And when regional our Caribbean brothers and sisters travel, we want them to be able to come to the countries and spend money in the countries. Huh? So perhaps maybe to really go farther there, hopefully other Caribbean countries do, and some do as well. Huh? Some do offer Caribbean rates for attractions and Caribbean rates for accommodation. I think that's something that we would have to more fully consider. But, you know, another thing that has happened, and maybe you find this is, you know, I mean, I was thinking traditional accommodation, but of course we have now a lot more non-traditional accommodation. So persons that offer their, you know, spaces, whether it's a home or apartments or whatnot, on services like Airbnb, so that, you know, for a traveler that's more budget conscious, these are also options. Yeah, so as I said, if you expand regional travel and there's more of it, we want persons to come, whether it's come to Barbados or go to another Caribbean country, but to spend money in the country, because you want it to be the case that it helps to turn over the economy. That's the real benefit of travel, is not just traveling to the country and coming back, but really spending money in the country.
Okay. Now, final question before I give you the chance to wrap up any thoughts that you may have. Now, the whole idea of the driver's license, we no longer need to have that that temporary license or visitor's license to drive in Barbados when persons come to Barbados. One, what would that do for the, again, competitiveness, attractiveness, ease of doing business, etc.? And also, the tax that has been added now back on to the hired vehicles, I think it's $10 for, I can't remember exactly the rate. Is that I don't know, giving it one hand, taking back with the other? I don't know. How you crunch the numbers for me and tell me how you see it.
So tell me that again. There's some of it that I missed. So you're saying that they no longer need the license, yes, to travel, to mean to drive once you...
But there's a tax attached to the hired cars, that the hired cars, I guess, would then factor into their costs. I'm seeing if I could pull up the actual thing.
Right.
I don't know if you would have seen that. I know it's $10, but I can't remember the exact rate. That $10 would be applied.
So this tax is something that's going to be collected by the rental companies and then passed on to government, is what you're saying?
That seems to be the idea.
Well, I guess in some ways what it does is it reduces the government's administrative costs, because instead then of persons having to, you know, go to the relevant site to get, you know, to pay the fee to get the license, it cuts out that, right? And so it saves government that particular cost administratively and time, so both in terms of money and time. And since any person wishing to drive obviously has to still go to the rental company to, you know, to rent the vehicle, then I guess it's a simpler thing in some ways. Because you do have to do it, and it's something that the rental company will just still attach to your to the cost of rental of the car. It then, in some ways, shifts it to the rental agencies. I mean, it's no additional thing for them to do, because they still do have to deal with all of the work relating to getting the person to rent the vehicle. I guess I would have to hear in terms of how it's remitted to government, if it's a situation where they just remit it in the same way that the companies have to remit, you know, the VAT, if it just happens there. Is there some other way to account for it? If not, then I suppose it's just really it's a doing business matter. And I think perhaps, you know, that is perhaps the best way in which we could say it would redound to Barbados. It eases the burden of the person coming to Barbados having to go do that before they can drive. And so to the extent that it helps to make business easier, if it's a business traveler, let's put it that way. I think that's a good initiative. I guess I will have to see really, you know, what sort of revenues could be collected from such a tax placed on rental vehicles by persons that are non-resident.
Yeah. And well, we are coming to the end of our broadcast, and you know, we would like to give you the opportunity to give us any finishing and closing remarks that you didn't get to put in your initial opening as it relates to the budget. Floor is yours, Professor Lord.
Well, thank you. So I guess what I will do, and because you see, budgets are, I would say, perhaps a continuum. And so if I speak about this one against the within the context of previous budget, let's say the last two budgets, what I will note here is that yes, and they did speak about some progress made in the last few years, and these things are notable and I would say commendable. But I would still say that tackling the cost of living is still a work in progress. I will tell Barbadians that, you know, governments truthfully, because people expect governments to lower prices, but I say governments can't directly lower prices. The prices are in the private sector. Where government comes in there, I'd say the main part of government's impact there in terms of price is already tariffs. Because when we say peak duties, I'm going to use the language of tariffs now, because that's what we hear internationally. A duty is a tariff, an import tax. So, I mean, because government uses the tariff to do two things, to protect local industries and so forth, but also it is a revenue collection mechanism, let's be honest. It serves a purpose. So if we remove that, so on one hand, you would hope, be able to at least lower the prices of items to some degree, but we'd also require the private sector to pass those on. As I said, I've really hardly ever seen that happen, but at least if government does that, you should hope to see that. But then on the other hand, if government is going to lose revenue, and revenue is going to be needed to do some of the same sort of provision of services that Barbadians are used to and become accustomed to and feel obviously quite entitled to. So I would say tackling the cost of living is still a work in progress. And so we have to think about the broader issue of import dependency. And, you know, as I said, it would be to enhance domestic production to reduce our vulnerability to global price shocks, right? And so greater investment in agriculture and alternative energy, as I said, is where we ought to go. I think I saw and I did hear, as I said, some efforts to assist agriculture, both in terms of access to funding, that agricultural development fund, talking about vertical farming and so forth. We'd have to see where that goes because, of course, you know, it's not a new technology to Barbadians, but it's not something widespread in terms of the provision of public services, Colville. So, I mean, it's something that I don't know numerically what it would be, but I would say that I've seen studies where it says, so we have to be, and not that we're doing badly here, but I'm just saying in terms of why we need the revenues is because there's two types of numbers I've heard of, read studies about. One, which is that the provision of good public services can reduce income inequality by 20%. That's a very significant figure. And then on the other hand as well, I've seen another study. It wasn't talking about Barbados, of course. It was speaking about it in the context of the United States, which is really that the provision of public services really adds something like about between $12,000 to $15,000 worth of value to persons that are in the lower income brackets. So this almost like getting the income in your hands. Yes, someone is suspending it for you because they're providing you those services. But coming back to what I'm saying when I'm landing here is that, yes, the provision of good public services is critical, is vital. And so I would say efforts to ensure that those providing those services in government, you know, that they're trained, that they're given the support that they need. I'd say to Barbadians, I mean, you know that these are not free. These services cost money. So when we think of things like provision of services at the hospital, the QEH, the polyclinics, the ability to get drugs off the drug formulary free at the point of delivery, all of these things, you know, the testing, the medication, the care of persons on non-communicable diseases, these are costly things. So I'd say that, you know, we have to, I know nobody wants to pay more taxes, but understand how these taxes are used to provide these services that we need. And isn't this extends into other things, education and so forth? All these things are important. All of these things, we don't get the money directly in our hands. But if we were to be able to value them, I gave you the example of what these mean to, say, persons in the United States, a study that did this estimate. That raises our incomes, right? not in a direct way, in an indirect way, by those amounts for persons that use those services. From the public private sector, I'd say I'd like to see a lot more entrepreneurial intent from the private sector. I think, you know, they do. I mean, they're trying, but I would say that there's not going to be a perfect world. I know, or timing for a lot of these things. And frequently they go to government for concessions to be able to do things. They essentially want government to insure the risk, basically get rid of the risk. So government takes on the risk. Well, they take on the profits. And saying government takes on the risk is no different from saying that the public takes on the risk. So we're socializing risks while the profits remain privatized. So there has to be a lot more entrepreneurial intent from the private sector. I know, given what's going to be happening globally now, that, you know, there's going to be heightened risks. But, you know, in the same ways that we need to band together as a country to do things at a social level, the private sector perhaps has to find ways also to manage, mitigate, and to hedge against risks that are external. And finally, climate resilience. You know, I heard a lot about that in the budget. I hear a lot about that from our prime minister when she traveled internationally about resilience. And I think the thing here with this, and persons I know in the public like to speak of, like, where is money being spent and how is it being spent? The thing about building resilience is that it's not something you will see until you're needing it, you know? So that if resilience is, say, ensuring then that, you know, that the coastal resources are protected, if we are hardening our infrastructure, you know, doing things like that, you know, it's not going to be something that you're going to recognize or see until perhaps something happens and then you're glad that it's there. So if you take, for example, the harbor in town where the boats went, and we saw that the breakwater wasn't high enough to really protect those boats. So imagine though, if it was to a level that we had even perceived could happen, then when it happened, we would have been glad we spent the money. But let's just say when you're doing it, nobody really appreciates that you're spending the money to build a seawall, let's say whatever height and whatever thickness. We're thinking about resilience in terms of, you know, what we do with our infrastructure. These aren't things that we will benefit from immediately or even directly. But I would say government is doing, I would say, a good job here. I would say my only concern is that sometimes the execution is slow. So I find that there are bureaucratic delays and bottlenecks. We borrow money and sometimes the monies aren't fully used. And so, you know, the thing we've heard, implementation deficit is a problem for some of these things. But, you know, I would say that to the extent, though, that we recognize that we do have challenges here in terms of implementation and execution, I don't know what and how the government can solve those sort of challenges. But, you know, if they can, I'd say that it would do a lot. It would go a long way in terms of, you know, helping to basically, as the Minister Strong said, it's Mission Barbados. Well, that's a big part of Mission Barbados now, building our climate resilience. But that's it for me, Colville. A multi ending, but that's where I'm going to stop.
No, I think you unpacked it quite nicely. And I really want to thank you for spending this hour with me and our listeners trying to unpack what was quite a lengthy budget and packed with quite a bit of information and help to parcel it out for Barbadians so that they can digest and, I guess, mull it over throughout the night and we'd have more opinions as the morning breaks. Thank you again for joining me, Professor Lord.
And yeah, thank you.
Do have a good night. This is Colville Munsey for State of the Nation, Nation News, signing out.
Hey, good night.
Good night.